talking about it for over a year, and you probably already know anyway, we've decided not to say it this time. So we're not going to tell you again that to protect yourself from COVID-19, you should wash your... And we certainly won't repeat once more that you should wear a... Or most importantly, that we must keep our... from others. Because you already know this is the best way to fight the virus. Even when you're vaccinated, let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Up to 4 million tourists coming each year to historic Palestine, and most of them visiting Jerusalem and the Dead Sea. And there's a clear connection here between both not only the displacement and the illegal land theft that predicates tourism at these illegal settlements, but also the economic deprivation that and suppression that results from that as well.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. Next month, the Israeli regime is set to open its borders to tourists who meet the various COVID requirements after over 18 months of being pretty much closed. Its tourism industry has taken a serious blow, as of course has the Palestinian tourism industry. Now, we may think of tourism as a rather benign aspect of the Israeli apartheid regime, but actually it plays a key role, specifically religious tourism, in legitimizing and expanding Israeli theft of Palestinian land. Joining me to discuss this on this episode is Hala Ahmad, a writer and policy analyst with a particular focus on social welfare, equitable development, and economic justice. She's also a former US policy fellow with Ashabaka. Now, Hala wrote a policy brief on this topic entitled Tourism in the Service of Occupation and Annexation, which was published last year. And you can find it on our website. Hala, thank you so much for joining me for this episode.
Thank you so much for having me, Yara.
Hala, perhaps we could start off with a historical background on Zionist tourism in Palestine and how this contributed to the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 on top of what is now colonized Palestine.
Thank you so much for hosting this topic and this podcast, Yara. It's true that this issue of tourism in service of occupation and annexation and in service of the Zionist settler colonial project has a long history. And in fact, you know, despite COVID-19 closures, the Israeli state has been working to dramatically build out its tourism in the occupied territories in preparation for the return of tourists and in preparation for the turn of administrations and support presumed within the White House with the change of hands from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. So, in fact, it's a crucial time to talk about this. But let me back up a little bit and start with the early days of Zionist colonization of Palestine. In the lead up to World War II, the Zionist movement did not have the kind of widespread support you might expect for a colonial effort that was just a few years away from committing the Nakba, displacing close to 1 million Palestinians and establishing the State of Israel. And many European Jews were not convinced that an ethno-religious state made sense. You know, they spoke different languages, were embedded in different civil and political life throughout Europe. And of course, that there are a lot of things that changed the calculus for the success of Zionism and the settler colonial movement that it represented. But early Zionist settlers in that vein founded what was called the Tourist Development Association of Palestine. And that entity, alongside the Jewish Colonization Association, were key actors in the social and economic project, which was being undertaken for Zionist colonization of Palestine. And they engaged in a number of projects to encourage migration to Israel, what they would call Israel. So some of the activities of the Tourist Development Association of Palestine included the creation of posters, the commissioning of posters. It included the commissioning of maps. And in coordination with the Jewish Colonization Association, also included other areas of touristic investment, including hotels. So just to give a picture of what those looked like, you know, some of the posters, you know, the most famous example of which is the Visit Palestine poster by Franz Krautz. You know, it pictures a silhouette of an olive tree in the foreground and looks out on the old city of Jerusalem, which has sort of a glow, an orange-yellow hue, greenery just within the walls, and Dome of the Rock in focus. It was among many posters with a vibrant landscape, but also many religious symbols, which were meant to sort of create part of this important mythology that the Zionist colonization efforts relied on to build the case for migration to Palestine. In addition to those posters, like I mentioned, were Zionist maps, which would impose presumed biblical sites on top of existing cities and topographies to create a visual anchor, both for Christian and Jewish audiences, to see the land of Palestine through the lens of antiquity and create an imaginary that there was this empty land of Palestine and an imaginary of Jewish continuity there. And the maps actually became serious anchors for planning extensive colonial settlement that would then actually obscure, you know, and erase indigenous Palestinians from the landscape. And these posters were important for establishing a number of founding myths and characterizing the landscape in ways that are very similar to other colonial movements of the time. You know, the founding leaders of the Zionist movement, you know, famously David Ben-Gurion and Moshe Chertok, the first and second prime ministers of Israel, used explicitly pejorative views to characterize the Palestinians living there at the time. They would say that they would bring modern cultural and scientific knowledge to make the wilderness bloom, and they would bring this sort of intellectual labor to Palestine. And in some cases, say, explicitly reflect that Zionists had come to conquer the land from people who had been inhabiting it with what he called savage culture. These were images and ideas that were reflected back in some of the tourist development materials and the posters that were put forward. And in fact, you know, surprisingly, despite the relative poverty that many Zionists will talk about for early Zionist settlers in Palestine, several dozen hotels emerged between, you know, 1917 and 1948, and some are still standing, including, you know, the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. So Tourism was a fundamental part of the founding mythology and the founding ideology for settling in Palestine and erasing Palestinians from the landscape, but also characterizing Jewish settlement as a sort of natural continuity with the past, which rested on, of course, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
Helen, you mentioned that really key to all of this was erasing Palestinians from the landscape. Can you explain to us a bit more how this was and continues to be done through the merging of archaeological practices with biblical narratives?
Archaeology becomes, much like tourism, hand-in-hand a political tool for Palestinian erasure. Edward Said writes about this in Orientalism. There was a concerted effort by Zionists to remove Palestinians from historical record, and this was done through selective archaeology and sort of an orientalizing depiction of indigenous Palestinians as I said, uncivilized, unadvanced, and all of this relative to this European settler population. And this was very important after the Nakba, because although early Zionists were very clearly and self-ascribed as a settler colonial movement, after 1948, they sought to transform that identity both internally and externally, and certainly wanted to quash any claims Palestinians to indigeneity and statehood. So, you know, Zionists use archaeology as a tool to continue legitimizing their claim to the land that they had confiscated by force. And so the fields of archaeology, you know, this is a very deep topic, and there's a lot of contestation in the matter in Palestine. And, you know, I only treat it very lightly in the brief, but a great source on this is Nadia Abulhaj, her book Facts on the Ground. And she writes about the ways in which, you know, in the 50s and 60s, Zionists would treat archaeology as a kind of national hobby. It was both communal activity and communal recreation and tourism around historic Palestine. And the key focus of that archaeological project was to validate the founding myths of this territorial claim of these European Jews to the land, which meant whether the archaeology was scientifically rigorous, you know, that's another question, but it was very important to try to lay facts on the ground, as Nadia says, surrounding this idea of Jewish continuity in Palestine, and particularly drawing on religious symbols and ideas as evidence. You know, in some cases, archaeological sites will have very little tangible artifacts, let's say, but a lot of biblical narrative surrounding it. And that becomes very important. And many of the sites that were a focus in that time became key touristic sites in the present. So archaeology and, you know, the tourism tied to a nationalistic practice of that, it continues to be central both in Palestinian lands theft and legitimization of the Israeli colonial project across historic Palestine. And this is especially true, I would say, in the West Bank and Jerusalem, which I'm sure we can talk about more modern examples of the ways that archaeology is used in the displacement of Palestinians.
And Hala, you mentioned importantly that archaeology became a hobby for a lot of Zionists in the early days. And indeed, actually, many archaeologists in the 60s and 70s were former army generals during the Nakba. And it was said that they would carry a trowel in one hand and the Old Testament in the other. And I think that's, you know, really testament to what they were searching for and what kind of archaeological practices they were engaging in. And as you said, this continues to today. And I think one example of this par excellence is what's happening in Silwan, the Palestinian neighborhood in Jerusalem and Silwan. The Zionist regime is literally digging archaeological tunnels under the homes of Palestinians, dislodging the foundations of these homes in the service of what they call archaeology, but also tourism, to put on a full display of continuous and ancient Jewish history in the city. And much of that archaeology and the archaeological practices that are actually contested by various different international bodies.
There are several important examples in Jerusalem that we could talk about. And the backbone to much of that problematic, to put it lightly, archaeological practice in Jerusalem is that, you know, there are two primary right-wing settler organizations that are operating in Jerusalem and seeking to, you know, in their own terms, really Judaize the neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, create a different demographic reality. And the two are Ateret Kohanim and Elad. And Elad, very interestingly, as a right-wing settler organization, very explicit right-wing ideologies, owns the primary contract for archaeological work in Jerusalem. In fact, they are meant to be a nonprofit organization, but their financial, a lot of their financial information is private because of this very crucial, let's say, archaeological contract that they have with the government. And, you know, they have this famous center that many, many religious tourists stop at, the Ir David Center and the City of David National Park in Wadi Silwan. And these centers, you know, they first of all, they create heavy policing within the Palestinian neighborhoods, but they are on confiscated land. And the archaeological projects that they have undertaken are putting many, many Palestinians at risk of eviction. You know, there was an, in El Bustan neighborhood, there was an eviction order for 1,300 or 1,500 families. And that was particularly for an archaeological sort of theme park to be built in place of their homes. And this is just one of multiple examples, not only an effort to Judaize the neighborhood, but also to use archaeology and also the pretense of that archaeology is to expand as well the Bible Trail, what they call the Bible Trail, throughout East Jerusalem. All of these archaeological pretenses are in service of displacement and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. So the tie there is very explicit and explicitly backed by the Israeli state as well.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
And part of that religious tourism also takes place in illegal settlements in the West Bank. Can you outline what the impact of this is on Palestinians there?
There's so much to say here. It's hard to give a full picture. But, you know, at baseline, the tourism and illegal settlements in the West Bank represents almost the most basic example of Israeli apartheid. You know, what happens is, in the simplest terms, illegal settlers claim the land, they build on it, are later recognized by the Israeli government, they build roads to and from the settlements that Palestinians cannot use, and they build touristic enterprises on that land. They then host tourists, particularly Christian tourists, and completely obscure and hide the theft and the military rule that enables them to be there on Palestinian land. They both profit from this enterprise and exclude Palestinians from those historical, cultural, and touristic sites, which would otherwise benefit the Palestinian economy. This is a violation of Palestinian self-determination and their right to sites of cultural, religious, and historical significance. And really, I mean, it's a spit in the face of Palestinian claims to statehood. So now you have the brutal Israeli occupation forces protecting these sites. And on top of that, you have Palestinians deprived of this economic development. You know, the tourists leave these sites with a false and constructed narrative of what the West Bank is like, with a confused notion of Palestinian realities within the West Bank, and particularly the Israeli occupation. And frankly, oftentimes with the, you know, reinforced Zionist narrative, that age-old narrative of superior Israeli development in contrast to Palestinian development, which is suppressed by Israel and really predicated on Palestinian oppression. So, you know, to give a scale of how much this is happening, settlers and the illegal settlement enterprise may account for, some would say, you know, up to 10% of the territory of the West Bank. But actually, a UN Human Rights Council report found that settlement councils control actually over 43% of the West Bank. And as part of that, 86% of the Jordan Valley and the Dead Sea, which are, you know, key areas not only for tourism, but also rich agricultural resources as well. So, you know, there was actually a PLO report that was put out in 2017 to talk a little bit about the direct ways that the Israeli state is partaking in depriving the Palestinian economy of the benefit of its own tourism sector and tourism resources. And it found that had Area C, which comprises 60% of the West Bank, which means it's under complete Israeli military rule, if that was transferred to Palestinians under the, you know, long failed Oslo Accords, there would be an unprecedented increase in the GDP of the Palestinian economy up to 35%. And, you know, you have up to 4 million tourists coming each year to historic Palestine, and most of them visiting Jerusalem and the Dead Sea. And there's a clear connection here between both the not only the displacement and the illegal land theft that predicates tourism at these illegal settlements, but also the economic deprivation that and suppression that results from that as well, in addition to the narrative piece that we've talked about. And there are many examples.
Right. And very often the tourists don't even realize that they are entering into the West Bank. You know, Israel blurs those lines on purpose. They bus in tourists to Bethlehem and they bus them out. And they also bus them into the illegal settlements. And to the unknowing tourists, they are still in Israeli territory. They have no idea that they've crossed into what's internationally considered as Palestinian territory. Now, the Israeli regime is said to be opening up its borders to tourists next month, November. And we already know, of course, that the first people that will be here will be Christian Zionist groups coming from the US. And as you write in your policy brief, these groups consider it a rite of passage to visit the Holy Land. So what exactly does that mean and what does it entail for these groups?
It's very important to understand the role of Christian Zionists here and the dominant role that they then play as tourists in this economic engine for the continued theft of Palestinian land. The major advocacy organization in the United States that represents Christian Zionists is Christians United for Israel, and it boasts 10 million members. That is 100 times as large as the members that represent AIPAC, which is the most notorious pro-Israel Zionist lobby in the U.S. And Christian Zionists are the largest and most significant source of support for Israel, both as an electorate and as donors. And in coordination with Jewish Zionist groups, Christian Zionists have successfully conflated Christian religious identity with support for Israel. And that's what it means to talk about this as a rite of passage. This is an explicit effort to use tourism as a political tool, to use religious tourism especially to create support for Israel as part of a Christian identity. The two things, the Christianity and support for Zionism, would seem so distinct, particularly because Christian Palestinians have long preserved Christian traditions and belief in the Holy Land, but are naturally opposed to Israeli apartheid, colonization, and oppression of Palestinians, which affects even their own practice of their faith, that, you know, whether it's practicing or celebrating Easter or Christmas, whatever it may be, the occupation forces will no less obstruct their lives as Palestinians. So evangelicals believe that supporting Jewish migration to Israel brings them closer to the return of Jesus. Oddly enough, when they also believe that Muslims and Jews alike would be annihilated. And there is a key case study of a Christian Zionist group that I talk about in the brief, which is really emblematic of the kinds of religious tourism that become extremely complicit in furthering the settler colonial agenda. So the example is Passages. It's a US-based group that was modeled after the Birthright trips that are much more notorious. And they provide a free trip to Israel for Christians at over 150 universities across the United States. And this includes many Christian colleges, but also a number of major public universities, Texas A&M, the University of Florida, the University of Minnesota host these trips. And they have, over the past 6 years or so, they've brought 7,000 students to Israel. Now, the trip itself, it is not apolitical, much as it is also meant to be ostensibly religious. It was the brainchild of former Israeli Ambassador Ron Dermer, who hosted the launch of this program at the Israeli Embassy in D.C. with none other than other former ambassadors, Michael Oren and most recently David Friedman. And the trip is meant to encourage, you know, this Christian support for the Zionist state. Quite cynically, the itinerary is quite explicit in its support for Zionist colonization of Palestine. They visit the Syrian-occupied Golan Heights on the itinerary, and this is based on research that was done by the Friends of Sabil North America and alongside some Palestinian student solidarity groups on campuses. Give them credit for that great research. And they explore Israeli startup culture. They tour the Knesset. They learn about Christian and Jewish persecution in the Middle East. And the idea here is that they are centering a very different narrative around Israel. First of all, leaning on that historic colonial mythology that Jewish settlement was this sort of modernizing force in Palestine, of the, you know, more uncivilized, as they would say, Palestinian population. You know, this focus on Israeli modernity is very problematic in that sense. And then visiting occupied territory, the Golan Heights, is flies totally in the face of many, many other trips that would even attempt to build a so-called two-sided perspective, let's say, of the issue. So what it does is it makes Christian tourism and Palestinian oppression really kind of two sides of the same coin by reinforcing this idea of Jewish continuity in Palestine and really overlooking any of the land theft that predicates this tourism industry. In fact, they even visit Sderot, which is this small city near Gaza, no religious significance at all, but was notorious in 2014 for residents putting up lawn chairs to watch the assault on Gaza, which killed 2,000 Palestinians and 73 Israelis in the process as well. And those kinds of itineraries are very clear and explicit in their attempt to create, you know, particular sympathies for the Zionist project, and it's a major source of continued support for the state of Israel among especially Christian tourists from the U.S.
Now, Hala, we've given a lot of space as to what the Israeli regime is doing and what Christian Zionists are also doing, but I really want to end on Palestinians and really to hone in on how they have resisted this, because obviously they have not been passive. And so I wanted, in the final question, wanted to ask you, how have Palestinians resisted this form of settler colonial tourism? And in that same tangent, what are the alternatives for people who want to practice a tourism that is in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle?
So firstly, Palestinians, of course, have never responded to this passively, this effort to erase their narrative. Palestinians have consistently both applied to build on their own touristic sites, whether it's in East Jerusalem. Or in tourism that doesn't cross the picket line, so to speak, and avoids complicity with the settler colonial enterprise. And Palestinians continue to manifest the reality of the apartheid system by being the first to document companies that have been complicit in the theft of their land and in the illegal settlement enterprise. Al-Haq is one organization that has done immense research on this much before groups like Amnesty International took up the helm as well to identify companies that have been complicit in this tourism industry on Palestinian stolen land. And members of Palestinian civil society have called for tourisms to engage in ethical tourism that does not go to touristic sites that are run by Israeli authorities and claimed as Israeli sites within Palestinian territories. There's a lot to say on that topic, but there are a number of resources and alternatives for people to the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott, put out a series of resources for creational and religious tourism. Eyewitness Palestine has a number of resources as well, Walk Palestine, the Siraj Center for Holy Land Studies, and on campuses throughout the United States as well, and even the UK, Palestine Treks, as they call them, are growing at campuses to provide an alternative to see Palestine from a Palestinian perspective without being complicit in the theft of Palestinian land and the continued oppression that Palestinians face across historic Palestine. And these are really important because, as I mentioned, during the period of COVID-19 and prior, tourism has been an explicit strategic investment of the Israeli state. You know, when Trump took office in 2016, Israel celebrated by approving what was a pretty unprecedented $20 million in settlement funding. And the then tourism minister and Netanyahu both had emphasized that tourism sites and construction of hotels in the West Bank settlements were primary targets for those funds. And then, anticipating potentially a turnover in administration in January 2020, Defense Minister Naftali Bennett approved the construction of national parks, nature reserves in the West Bank as part of over $110 million spent in the first quarter of the year on West Bank settlements, which was the highest in a decade and, you know, even definitely several times more than even the unprecedented numbers in prior years that had been spent. So tourism continues to be an explicit strategic priority because it is part of the larger effort to legitimize the settler colonial project that continues in the West Bank and the theft of Palestinian land in East Jerusalem and throughout the West Bank. And it is an economic engine for that enterprise as well. But there are alternatives, and investing in those alternatives for Palestinian tourism is both a way to economically support Palestinians and be in solidarity with them as they resist the apartheid regime that exists across historic Palestine.
Another great resource is the Grassroots Jerusalem book, Wajud, which was published a couple of years ago back now, which is a guidebook to Jerusalem and promotes a much more politically responsible tourism and really focuses on Palestinian existence within the city. Hala, you've in such a short time very clearly and succinctly laid out how Israeli tourism and the Israeli tourism industry contributes to the theft of Palestinian land and is deeply complicit and active in the oppression and continued occupation of the Palestinian people. So thank you so much for joining me. I'd love to continue this discussion, but I think we'll leave it there for now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. Please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
No! Welcome to the MondoWise podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At MondoWise, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. Striketober is upon us. Across the United States, workers in multiple industries are striking, quitting their jobs, and engaging in solidarity actions demanding better working conditions. The Movement for Palestinian Liberation has long interacted with labor struggles around the world, and this moment is no different. Michael Aria has been tracking this interaction and recently spoke to organizers in the tech industry working to counter something called Project Nimbus. Hi, Michael. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Hey, Dave. Good to be here.
So how are we seeing the issues around Palestinian liberation and Israeli apartheid manifesting inside the wave of worker solidarity and action that's happening right now across the United States?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that workers, you know, stoppages and strikes that are happening now in the United States, people referring to this month as Striketober. We've seen, you know, workers at John Deere and Kellogg's fighting for fair wages. We saw that walkout at Netflix in solidarity with the trans community. I was just reading that there might be a massive strike at Kaiser. That's just a few off the top of my head. But yeah, there's been some overlap between our beat and labor organizing, certainly, in recent months. You know, this spring we saw Israel carry out deadly attacks on Gaza, of course. But we also saw solidarity from many workers across the world. We saw South African workers refuse to offload the ship of an Israeli company. We saw Italian dock workers refuse to load an arms shipment to Israel. Here in the United States, we saw Block the Boat protests, which we covered pretty extensively at the site. I'd encourage everyone to check out our stuff on that and how truck drivers acted in solidarity in those cases. And I'd also mention that in June, the Seattle Education Association passed a resolution expressing solidarity with Palestine and endorsing the BDS movement. And it also condemned the relationship between Seattle Police Department and Israel. So I think we're definitely seeing more activism around this issue since those attacks in May, and we're seeing more overlap between the labor fight and the Palestinian struggle. And our interview today covers one of those instances.
Yeah, you recently spoke to some organizers working right in this space between labor issues and Palestine. So tell us about the interview that we're going to hear in just a moment.
Yeah, so just to back up a little, on October 12th, The Guardian ran an open letter that was signed by hundreds of workers at Google and Amazon. Those two companies recently signed a contract with Israel to provide their military and their government with cloud services, essentially. In the interview, we'll get into the details of what that might mean and how it might potentially be used by Israel. But I just wanted to maybe read a section of that letter that ran in The Guardian quickly. It says, quote, "We cannot look the other way as the products we build are used to deny Palestinians their basic rights, force Palestinians out of their homes, and attack Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Actions that have prompted war crime investigations by the International Criminal Court. We envision a future where technology brings people together and makes life better for everyone. To build that brighter future, the companies we work for need to stop contracting with any and all militarized organizations in the U.S. and beyond. These contracts harm the communities of technology workers and users alike. While we publicly promise to uplift and assist our users, contracts such as these secretly facilitate the surveillance and targeting of those same users. We condemn Amazon and Google's decision to sign the Project Nimbus contract with the Israeli government, with the Israeli military and government, and ask them to reject this contract and future contracts that will harm our users. We call on global technology workers and the international community to join with us in building a world where technology promotes safety and dignity for all." End quote. You'll notice the reference to Project Nimbus, which, as they mentioned, is a contract worth over $1 billion that those two companies just signed with Israel's government and their military. So after that letter ran in The Guardian, a number of human rights organizations actually heeded that call, and then they began a campaign called No Tech for Apartheid. That coalition around that campaign includes groups like Palestine Legal, JVP, If Not Now, American Muslims for Palestine, many others. And today I spoke with an Amazon worker named Bethul. We're not using a last name there, as there's some obvious concerns about backlash. We're also taking part in the interview with Sajal Nasrallah from Empower Change. Empower Change is one of the groups involved in the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. So he's going to talk about those efforts.
Well, thanks a lot, Michael. We'll look forward to listening to this interview in just a moment, and I'm sure we'll have you back on to keep us up to date on these developments.
Great. Thanks, Dave. First, I wanted to start with Project Nimbus. I was wondering if you could just describe what it is and how it's used by Israel. Today, in fact, we saw Israel declare a number of human rights groups as terrorist organizations. So connected to that, I was also wondering what impact something like Project Nimbus might have in terms of surveilling people within Palestinian civil society.
One of the big issues that we have with this contract is that we don't actually know much about it. All we know is kind of what's been reported on, which is quite limited. But what we do know, which is kind of the important part, is that we know that the contract, and there's kind of two pieces that we are sort of focusing on in regards to what the contract's about. One is that the contract can provide services and will provide services to really any part of the Israeli government. So that's including the Israeli military, also including the Israeli Land Authority, which, according to Human Rights Watch, uses discriminatory policies to expand segregated settlements, while, of course, trapping Palestinians in densely populated areas. We know as well that the contract also has a clause that disallows the companies to cut the contracts based on any type of employee demand. So essentially what's exactly happening now. And that's problematic for multiple reasons, but it kind of draws the question as to why did the companies enter into a contract knowing that it would be controversial, knowing that it could be problematic, and that workers would and the public would demand for the contract to be dropped, as they've done in the past with similar types of contracts. So that's also a big issue. Just kind of for more generally around your kind of getting back to your original question around what the contract actually allows for and what it will do. It provides beyond just the actual technology. It also provides for data centers on the ground. So we don't know the extent to kind of what the data will all be used for and what the technology will all be used for. But we know the crimes that Israel has committed, and so we can rightfully assume that this technology will allow for those crimes to be further committed.
Earlier this month, there was an open letter that ran in The Guardian condemning the contract with Israel, and it was signed by hundreds of Amazon and Google employees. I'm wondering if you have any indication of how many people signed that letter initially when it ran, and now, you know, it's over 2 weeks later. I'm wondering if you have any idea how many workers have signed it since it ran in The Guardian.
Yeah, I think when it first ran in The Guardian, I believe there was around 400 worker signatures. Since then, we now have over 1,100, and the numbers are continuing to grow, which is great as more and more people find out about it. On top of that, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more, but we also have the public sign-ons, which I believe are around 20,000 at this point. So as we are kind of getting a little bit more, I guess, publicity around the letter and around the topic, we're definitely seeing the numbers increase and hoping that continues.
Let's jump into that, where you just mentioned this No Tech for Apartheid campaign, which was launched shortly after the letter was published in The Guardian. Who's involved in that effort? How is it organizing? What are its goals? How can people support it? And where can they get more info?
Sure. Happy to jump in. So the No Tech for Apartheid campaign is a coordinated effort to back the workers at Google and Amazon's demands for their companies to drop Project Nimbus. And that work has been led by Jewish Voice for Peace and Empower Change, which I which I represent, the main goals is that we don't want to see this contract in play. We want to see it dismantled. Fundamentally, the core idea which drives this campaign is that we believe that technology should be used to bring people together, not facilitate and entrench violence and segregation. As you can see, not only is there, you know, not only did the workers spearhead this work, but there's so many people of conscience around the globe who are so interested in being involved. Since the May siege in Gaza earlier this year, we've seen a renewed and reinvigorated and unprecedented movement in solidarity with Palestinian life. And we also see that interest in this campaign. So for folks who are listening to this podcast or folks who have maybe heard about this campaign, there's really an easy way to get involved. Just going to notechforapartheid.com. Some background on the campaign is there, as well as a button to send and sign a joint letter that will be delivered to decision makers both at Google and Amazon. So pretty easy to get involved. In addition to the workers and the international community, the progressive movement broadly across North America and internationally has also gotten involved with dozens of organizations co-signing this demand and only growing.
Sure. I spoke with an activist connected to the campaign targeting Ben and Jerry's a couple months ago, and they really felt that Israel's most recent attacks on Gaza, which happened in May, really pushed their campaign over the edge in terms of public awareness around it. As you know, two people who organize around this issue consistently, I'm wondering what you thought about those attacks increasing awareness around the situation in Palestine. And I'm also wondering if you believe they've altered the state of pro-Palestine activism in any way going forward.
Yeah, a couple initial thoughts, and I'd love to hear Sajal's thoughts as well. But I think one of the great things that we saw this summer is that more people kind of felt empowered to get engaged. I think a lot of that was because of the Palestinians who were sharing on social media and allowing all of us to kind of get a daily insight into the terror that they're facing. And that really gave, I mean, oftentimes this is painted as a complex issue and you need to kind of have a 40-year history understanding to be able to have an opinion on the issue, but that's not true. And I think people really understood that now that they're seeing kind of what's happening and they're getting that first person account of the situation for Palestinians, it becomes more clear cut. Right? Folks are able to understand that there's a huge difference in power, that people aren't able to do kind of the most basic daily activities, like just freely travel, freely be in their own homes. So I think all of that is kind of helping to change the narrative and the awareness around the situation. And I think it has altered activism in the way that people feel like they can get involved, even if they're not, you know, quote unquote, professional activists like myself. I don't know if I would necessarily say that I'm an activist, but I do feel like I have the ability to get involved just based on what I've seen. And there of course comes, for really anybody that kind of has a conscience and is seeing these things happening, like it's hard to not get involved, right? So I think that's increasing the involvement as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with everything that Batul had mentioned. And, you know, and I'll answer this question as well, just from the perspective, I mean, of being a Palestinian, also an activist and a community organizer, that, I mean, fundamentally, I do believe that it has been uplifting in many ways to see the increase in involvement and public awareness and activity around Palestinian solidarity overall. The more the merrier. This work will require all of us. The fact that this continues to happen at the tail end of just massive displays of violence on Gaza is just extremely disheartening, and very much so why we hope that we can organize as deeply and as powerfully as we can before the next batch of bombs hit Gaza. But it's undeniable, right? From a media standpoint, the public narrative on the significance of Palestinian life is changing. Not only that, right, the rhetorical weapons in which Israel has used for far too long to justify military occupation, massacre of Palestinians simply doesn't carry the same weight. And I do believe that we are living in visionary times, and that the truth and sheer power that backs the vision for a future of Palestine that's free from apartheid is really much, much more powerful than it has ever been. So I, you know, this might kind of lean into other places, but I'm hopeful. I'm continuing to be hopeful when I see the world like tired of grieving daily atrocities committed by Israeli apartheid. I'm hopeful when I see taxpayers not wanting to send their money to be turned into bombs that orphan children or demolish hospitals. And I am especially hopeful when workers don't want their labor to buttress apartheid walls or checkpoints or back ethnic cleansing campaigns. That all is true. And I hope to kind of continue to see more of this kind of activism as we continue to fight for Palestine free from apartheid.
A great segue into my next question. You know, people have this campaign's being launched at a very interesting time domestically. People have been referring to this month as Striketober. We've had workers at places like John Deere and Kellogg's fighting for better wages, Netflix workers taking a stand in defense of trans rights with their walkout, and we have this campaign. I'm wondering if either of you had thoughts about kind of the overlap between the labor movement and the fight for Palestinian rights, and just thoughts on the importance of this moment and how it might relate to some of these wider fights.
Yeah, one of the questions that we've been getting often is, you know, how do you, as tech workers, how do you think that this fits in with workers' rights more generally? And do you think this is unique? You know, we often see workers, like you mentioned, fighting for better wages and better working conditions and things like that. So we get asked this a lot. But, you know, one thing that I'll note is that we have seen instances, of course, of tech workers standing up in multiple ways against different similar contracts and other things like this. And the Netflix workers example that you shared as well is kind of showing this interesting trend, I think, of we have such a long and powerful history of workers that stand up for their own working conditions and wages and all of those things. But now we're seeing a wonderful trend of workers who are telling their employers that they no longer want their work, whether indirectly or directly, to contribute to any of these multitude of problematic things that companies may be involved in. So we do think that this is really a critical campaign amongst so many others to indicate that we as workers do have a say in what's happening. And we really, I mean, the only way that we can win any of these struggles is if workers collectively come together and fight for, you know, whether it's Palestinian rights in this case or any of the rights that we see are not being met as a result of companies' actions and business practices.
This one for Bethul specifically, are you concerned at all about the potential backlash from taking the stand from the company? Obviously, Amazon has, you know, a very public, disturbing track record of targeting workers who organize. Are you nervous about that at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the biggest thing and what's really driven those of us who have been public to speak out about this is we know that we have the right to speak out against the companies that we work for. We have the right to call for them to take a stand and commit to ethical business practices and ethical and doing contracts in an ethical way. So we really feel like despite what may happen, it's much more important that we voice our opinions and make those opinions heard, because we have the right to do so. I will also say that those of us who have been public, you'll notice that it's not a coincidence that the few of us that have been public are not Palestinian. And that's actually something that we do kind of want to highlight, in that Palestinian workers who are a part of this organizing, and there are many who are part of this organizing, are not speaking out publicly specifically because of the types of surveillance and discrimination and violence that this contract will allow for and further facilitate by Israel. They have a fear that there may be retaliation because they're speaking out publicly. And those of us who aren't Palestinian don't have that same fear. So we feel it's even more important that we do speak up and make our points heard. And the support that we talked about earlier amongst other workers and amongst the public really solidifies the idea that we have, that what we're doing is not only important, but also necessary, and that we do have the backing from so many organizations, so many members of the public, and our fellow workers in calling on both of these companies to drop the contracts.
Well, thank you both so much for taking time to speak with us today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider becoming a donor by visiting MondoWeiss.net/donate. Mondo Weiss is a nonprofit publication, and every donation of any amount helps sustain our work.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Tell your girlfriend, get changed, you're dressed like a tramp. Change your password so I can see your messages. When are you going to change your mind, you stubborn idiot? Change your attitude when you talk to me. Change your friends. You better change your tone of voice. It's not up to her to change. It's up to you. Violence against women stops now. Talk about it. Do something about it. And call SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.